Hey, and we are back on the Cannabis Corner right here on Radio Tacoma and KTQA. My name is Lucas Barfield, and I'm a local Tacoma cannabis activist, reporter, and writer. And I am joined by a medical cannabis activist and veteran from Oregon, Uncle Dig. How you doing today, Dig?
Hey, I'm doing good. We've got a sunny day and to break up some of that dreary monotony here in the Northwest, so it's looking pretty good, and I'm in a good mood from the sunshine.
Yeah, we actually have sunshine today here, too. And before we get started on the show, we just want to kind of recap something we have going on, which is this interaction we're having with our audience. So what we are doing here is we're going to have people send in their first time getting high stories, and you can either send them in via recording, so you can use your phone or a computer. There's a great program out there that's free called Audacity, if you'd like to download that and record and send it over there to us. Or you can write it up, and Dig will read it right here on the air. And you, of course, can do this anonymously, because we still know and we still talk about how cannabis is taboo and some workplaces don't like it. So feel free to be anonymous, and we will not put your name on the air. So, Dig, tell us how people can send in their first time getting high stories.
They can send it in to UncleDig4 at gmail.com. That's UncleDig, UNCLEDIG4 at gmail.com. Or you can contact me directly on Instagram at UncleDig.
Yeah, you guys go over there and check out Uncle Dig's Instagram. He does some stuff with growing and some other things there. So go check that out at Uncle Dig's Instagram there. And then we are happy today we have a guest on, Dan McMahon, and we're going to be talking about traceability and all this other stuff. And that is some really important news coming out with traceability as far as where we're going with this. And I was reminded how important traceability is. I had to go down and talk to the Labor and Commerce Committee, and they were talking about down there how medical cannabis needs help, and they were wanting to hear from patients. And I was the patient representative there talking about you know, we really need to improve medical cannabis in the state, and I was mentioning how they need to remove the 37% excise tax on cannabis. I want to ask you a question real quick, Dick. Do they have a medical cannabis excise tax in Oregon?
No, they do not. One of the ways they were able to convince our medical community to kind of get with the program, as it were, is you don't pay if you're a medical patient and you're an OMMP card holder. That's an Oregon Medical Marijuana Program card holder. You go into a dispensary, you do not pay taxes on your cannabis. You are exempt from those taxes.
Yeah, hear that, Washington? Washington State is the only state that I know of in the entire country with an excise tax on veterans and people with disabilities and medical cannabis patients. Medicine. So, and it's actually really high, a 37% excise tax on top of that. So I was down testifying, trying to get that removed. And, you know, I just don't always know if the senators are listening, but hopefully we're wearing them down and we can get a little movement on this medical cannabis front and home grows too, which just to put that out there, we're going to be interviewing somebody from Washington Home Grow coming up in the next couple shows.
Cool.
All right, so we're going to jump into our first story, which is coming out of Illinois. And if you've seen it, Illinois legalized recreational cannabis via the legislative process, I believe back in 2018. And they've been having some really big numbers over there as far as the sales. Have you seen some of those numbers over in Illinois, Dig?
You know, I have, and I think that's just a flash in the pan to compared to overall cannabis sales there. Their taxes, as I understand, are a little steep, so a lot of people are priced out of the market. But I think as that market gets bigger and maybe they lower those taxes a little bit, it'll become more accessible. However, a good thing about how Illinois legalized is they set up an organization and deviated some of those tax fundings directly to go toward expungement, which is a really, really interesting and good thing that Illinois is doing. Now it's going to take, they estimate, about 5 years to process these expungements because there are 70,000 Illinois citizens eligible for expungement under the state law. And so they earmarked these cannabis taxes to go directly to this New Leaf program they're calling. This expungement program, New Leaf, Illinois. And Illinoisans with an arrest or conviction for marijuana can go to newleafillinois.org and fill out a form to be paired with a legal professional from one of 20 member organizations to determine what options are available to them. They can also call the New Leaf Illinois hotline at 855-963-9532.
Yeah, you can get that number if you didn't quite catch it over at the Peoria Journal Star. And there's a really good article over there talking about this. And this comes from a 1999 law, actually, in Illinois that set up a thing called the Illinois Equal Justice Foundation, which is a state agency that divvies out money to nonprofits for legal aid and initiatives like this. And so apparently Illinois has sort of been doing this kind of thing for a long time. Just now they're ramping it up to deal with the cannabis arrests over time. And then also, on top of all these expungements, the governor is over there pardoning people.
It's good. I've been, if not impressed with the way that they have rolled out legalization in Illinois, I have been impressed with the efforts they've been making toward equity and expungement in a way that some other states, looking up north and here in Oregon as well, haven't done as good a job.
Yeah, and so the next story, speaking of haven't done as good a job, we're going to move back over here to Washington, and we're going to talk about a story about something new coming out. And I think we're going to talk to Dan about this later. But this is called the Cannabis Regulatory Association. And this is a new group that's coming out across the nation, and it's made up of people from all around the country that have worked in the cannabis legalization field as far as in the government and making regulations. And just so happens that the vice president is our very own Rick Garza from the Washington State Liquor Control Board. Now, this is not necessarily a good thing, seeing as how we talk about on this show a lot how bad a lot of the regulations are in Washington. And in fact, in the article, the one I was reading in the, I think it's Spokane Public Radio, was interviewed Mr. Garza, and he was talking about how they were going to take the medical cannabis regulations we have across the country and share that with the country. And, you know, I don't necessarily think that is a good thing.
Your medical, I mean, yeah, we don't really want someone who's a regulator from a state such as Washington to poison the pill, poison the whole bathwater for everybody else. I mean, I am a little bit unnerved that they're trying to make a regulatory agency that's has multiple states in it ahead of the federal government. One of the great things about United States cannabis legalization is that the states have been able to go their own way. So while Washington is very restrictive and prohibitive and mean-spirited in the way they control the plant, Oregon was able to go a different way. And some other states may have even increased access more than Oregon has. So I really hesitate when people look to Washington State as a good model, because it's not.
Yeah, it really is not. And matter of fact, we just had 3 months of testimony. You can go over to the WSLCB website and find this on social equity and how the medical cannabis system used to be made up of a lot of black people of color, indigenous, Latino, Asian, all types of people owned medical cannabis shops and were producers back then. And along came Washington, and they kind of just tilled all that under in the hopes of growing a new system. And now we have Rick Garza is going to be taking that nationwide, and so we really need to be a little wary of these big organizations that take out this stuff, in my opinion. So let's keep an eye on that, Dig, and we'll come back to it at another time.
We should. I just would like to say, when I tout Oregon's cannabis market and the way it regulates as a good example, I mean that it's a good example as far as ensuring patient access. It can always be better. There's definitely room for improvement in Oregon, and there's definitely room for improvement on the equity side in Oregon. I'm not saying that we've got the equity side down at all. We definitely don't.
Yeah, few people do. Illinois, like we just mentioned, is trying, but they're even having problems. But we're coming along with it, and it is a lot of work to do. And I frankly think we need a social equity program across the entire system. So that's a whole nother topic, and it is a really big thing going on in a great movement going on right now with social equity. So let's keep an eye on that camera. The next thing we're going to talk about is the it's kind of a two-part story, and one of those is stocks over the past week, or cannabis stocks over the past week, have really been booming because there was an expected vote by the UN to lower the schedule for cannabis. And lo and behold, the vote happened today, Dig. How'd they vote?
They voted to go ahead and do the UN version of saying that cannabis was less dangerous than drugs such as heroin and methamphetamine and stuff like that. So they've kind of lowered the schedule rate. So it's as I understand it, I'm not an expert on international law by any means, but it seems like they've moved cannabis from their equivalent of a Schedule 1 down to a Schedule 3 or 2. Does that seem how it's like to you, Lucas? I'm not. It's kind of hard for me to understand this stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot. And I think we're going to find a guest to come on and talk about this, because it's a lot of different international law that's been going on for over 100 years, kind of all entangled. So, they kind of lowered the schedule down from, it seems like I said, about from a 1 to maybe a 2 or 3. But the experts warn that this isn't going to do a whole lot to relieve a lot of cannabis laws around the country, because it's set up where it's still like, oh, well, you know, it's not as bad as heroin, but it still can be bad. And, as we talk about on this show a lot, cannabis use does have risk. You want to be careful. You want to educate yourself. But so does driving a car or using alcohol or anything else. So,
for sure.
I'm wanting to see what happens with the stock market now. But one of the things, this kind of leads us right into our next story, which is about Mexico. And they are about to make adult use cannabis legal. And I feel like this could jumpstart a conversation that we could just take up for the whole rest of the show.
I want to go to, as I get older, I kind of see the Mexico thing, but I'm not much of a drinker. Now, Cabo is starting to look really nice if weed's legal.
Yeah. And I mean, it's crazy because Mexico is getting set up to be the biggest cannabis market in the world. And then you got
125 million people.
Yeah, that's really big. And then you got Canada that is above us. And what this is setting up is an international market, because countries like Colombia, Australia, I know Switzerland does CBD, but there's some other countries in South America that are actually exporting high THC cannabis back and forth.
Yeah.
Then Mexico's going to start.
I think that United States of America is missing out on an opportunity here.
No big
time. Have the best agricultural infrastructure to take advantage of an international cannabis market. We can grow better, higher grade stuff for less market. And here's the best part. We export the big factory farms to Mexico and Canada, and we keep the good homegrown stuff here. Let's do it. What are we waiting for? We literally have a way to corner the market on this and grow some of the best weed in the world and then give it to the world. Our new export can be cannabis, not arms. It would be amazing. It's a little corporate and it's not the way we thought it would happen, but I'll take it over what we're doing now.
Oh, definitely. And it's really I really applaud Mexico for pushing this forward and actually beating the United States. I know here in the United States, I don't have this attitude, but everybody wants to think, oh, well, Mexico's behind the times and all these kind of things. So I really am applauding the government of Mexico for standing up. And one of their past presidents has actually been pushing this for Vicente Fox, I believe his name is, has been pushing this for a long time. And he's spoken here in Washington at a couple conferences. But they've been trying to get this going, and I know they legalized medical cannabis. And it's just going to – I think it's going to change the whole entire sort of cannabis landscape, because then people talk about the cartels are kind of going to harder drugs, but they still are involved in the cannabis trade. So what I'm wondering is are we going to start getting large amount of Mexican cannabis shipped over the border to states that like New Mexico, where cannabis is still illegal? Texas. Yeah, Texas is highly illegal in Texas. I remember back in the late 1990s, I had a friend from Texas. We could go to Texas and get ounces for $10. Now, we never made that trip, but is that going to go down to like $5? You know, so
Well, and if their infrastructure down south is illegal, they might come up with better ways to package it, which might result in a better product. Because back in the day, we used to use the term brown frown. It was, you know, weed that would come across the border in bales. And it wasn't even really worth it, which is why it was so cheap. But if they're not bailing it, if they're coming up with other ways to ship it across and it's still green, and it's $10 an ounce, that would truly be something now, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so just really interesting times coming up in the cannabis world and cannabis politics. So we will be keeping an eye on all that. But right now we're going to get on to our interview. Yeah, hey, so we are back on the Cannabis Corner, and we are doing our interview today, and we are joined by Dan McMahon, and he is going to be here talking to us about traceability and the history of seed to sale and some other stuff we're going to be talking about, and Dig is here with us too. So how you doing today, Dig and Dan? What's going on today, guys?
I'm doing great.
Yeah, absolutely wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great to hear. So we're going to jump right in, and so Dan was sort of on the early days of traceability back in 2012 and 2013, back when it first got started. And, you know, traceability is one of these things where it hasn't always been out there in cannabis culture, because as we all know and as we talk about on this show a lot, it comes from a more of a underground culture because of it's illegal. So there hasn't always been like the need to why do we want to track this stuff? And I remember when I first started going to the dispensary in 2013, I would go in and say, hey, I'd like this flower. And the guy would go over to the computer and, you know, he would enter in the data what I was buying there. And I never could see what he was using. And I'm not sure if it was the product you were working with, Dan. But it was interesting to see that they were actually beginning to trace cannabis. And so tell us a little about that, kind of how that came to be back in the early days of traceability.
Sure. So there's really two different sides you have to understand. Is there's commercial traceability systems, which are the more localized systems that the producers, the growers, cultivators, the processors, oil makers, packagers, as well as the retailers utilize for their business needs, which does a lot of the inventory tracking functionality as well as maintains their actual system of records. And then there's traceability from a government standpoint, which is basically a complete system of record for that, that usually those systems will connect to electronically through something called an API or an application programming interface. It's just basically a language that allows a real-time connection, so they don't have to manually log into the government-issued website and try to enter an information. That way, they can use something that they're more comfortable with as long as the information is kind of there. But as far as the early days, especially up here in Washington, while it's possible in 2012, 2013, that there were a couple of the medical places that were using for a point of sale the BioTrack system, but for the most part, it would have actually been there was a free system called MMJ Menu that was pretty much the exclusive one on there across the board for a long time. It's not really in use in major parts anymore. It was purchased by Weed Maps a number of years ago, and they haven't really pushed it too heavily or anything like that. It kind of died down in the corner. But for the longest time, pretty much every localized medical dispensary was just using that free platform.
Yeah, and then along came legalization, and that was in 2012. But the market never really got up and going until 2014. And they had the Cole memo. And just to remind everybody what that was, it was the federal government. They outlined a couple rules back when Washington and Colorado passed legalization, and one of those was, well, you're going to need to trace this, and you're going to need to follow us around. And they really are big into, and they still are today, making sure that cannabis doesn't make it outside the state. So tell us a little bit about how the Cole memo evolved seed-to-sale tracking, and kind of where are we at right now, because the Cole memo has gone away. So kind of what's the status of traceability right now?
Sure. So with the Cole memo coming into place, like you said, it was the federal government essentially saying that if you do these specific guidelines, and it was a very rough set guideline, we're not going to get involved. We're not going to put out resources to get involved with the industry, and we're going to let your state's rights and resources control those particular things. And one of the biggest pieces for that was diversion into other states. So making sure that the product itself did not leave there, and that it was also put together to not get put into the hands of minors. Those are basically the two biggest no-nos that were outlined by the Cole memorandum. Mm-hmm. But that's what actually set the precedent for traceability in the beginning. There were not actually government traceability systems in place prior to that, at least not for cannabis. Washington was actually the first one of its kind to issue a request for proposal for software companies to actually build something very custom and unique to the rules around cannabis. Colorado, which came on essentially at the same time, had a pretty decent regulatory body for their medical system, which was a lot less gray market than it was here in Washington. So it was an easier transition for them to start going into those. But Washington was actually the first one to implement those.
So this is Dig here. So I understand that the reason that they wanted to trace was primarily to prevent diversion and to prevent it falling in the hands of minors. Is that correct?
Yes.
So in your estimation, I know that we might not have great statistics about it, but in your estimation, did it work or is it working?
Yeah. So it's definitely made a big impact for as far as that goes. Now, there's always going to be some level of diversion that occurs, especially because of the way that the markets are set up. And the thing about traceability and how it works is people need to understand that all it is a digital representation of the physical. So it's only as good as what you actually put into it and what you do to the system itself. If you completely ignore something that you physically have in your facility in the system, then the system has no way of automatically just knowing it's there. And that's where some confusion comes in with other states where they utilize RFID technology for putting that in there.
That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah.
I was wondering how they did it. So in Washington, it's data driven. So if you count a seed at a breeder, you're inputting a digital fifth blueprint, but you're not tagging that seed or actually tagging that plant.
So no, you are actually tagging. What you're just utilizing in Washington is a barcode itself. Now, when it comes to the small batches of plants, as well as say a container full of seeds, you're not individually putting one of those barcodes on every single one. While they're still in the early stages for those, they actually get a single barcode identifier for an entire batch.
So you're not making, so breeders aren't counting each individual seed, at least not in Washington.
Well, they're theoretically supposed to. They're supposed to have the number of seeds ahead of time. Now, there's usually some level of acceptable variance.
It would be a nightmare the way cannabis produces seeds.
Yes. Yeah. For any that are on hand to be turned into other plants, those are still supposed to be accounted for in the system itself. You just attach a quantity number to a specific batch. And then after you plant them, and in Washington state, there's actually a specific size threshold. So once the plant grows to 8 inches for that, you're supposed to individually put a specific tag on there for that plant, in which case that tag will actually stay on that plant for the duration of its entire life until you harvest it, cut it down, and put it into ready for process.
See, and this is the kind of detail that a lot of people are interested but have no way of finding out how intricately they track cannabis in Washington state. And in some other states are setting up, I'm sure, similar systems. Oh, yeah. And it just adds a lot of administrative burden that I don't think people think about when they think about this industry.
Yes. No, I mean, it's a lot more complex than a lot of people think. I've actually heard in a number of cannabis forums, people reference it to glorified spreadsheets. But it is a lot more complicated than that, because in addition to having an identifier for that plant that follows it throughout the life of the plant, anything that you do to that plant, applying pesticides to it, certain watering schedules, what you actually get for your harvest on a plant-by-plant basis, as well as a batch of plants when you're pulling those down, those are all associated attributes. And then once it goes through the curing process, and then you put it into actual defined lot sizes for that, and you pull out a representative sample to send to a laboratory at that point, you then have to have the appropriate test results that will actually apply to that specific lot. Now, once that's created, you can't add any more to it. It's essentially, you get a big tote that's 5 pounds in Washington. For the limits in Oregon, it's 10 pounds. It really depends on what state you're in, but essentially these defined batches of finished product and the test results that get associated with those, you can deplete from that product, but you can't add any additional to it. Otherwise, those samples wouldn't be considered representative samples of that particular batch.
Thank you for going into that detail for us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, and that really, when you're talking about all that detail and some of the new things coming out in traceability, Washington's traceability system right now is sort of in a just a wait and see kind of pattern right now. I think it's still working, but I know they're not adding to it, and they've had a whole lot of problems with it. But there's a lot of talk these days about using blockchain, and like, and I know in like grocery store market chains, they have blockchains already, because you can detect all, add all these things, and it's definitely not changeable, and it's all right there on the public record. So do you see any future for blockchain going forward in the cannabis industry traceability systems?
Yeah, I do. And it's a little bit loaded of a question for that, because the thing about blockchain is when you're using it, essentially it's an immutable ledger for that, which means it can't be edited for a specific entry for that. And it's in all of the different locations at the same time that it's actually being transferred to. So it's changing one specific record isn't going to do you any good as far as being able to access some of those other pieces. Now, some of the concerns that a lot of people have had with traceability in general, especially for the first several years when there was a little bit better insight with the original traceability system that was implemented in 2014 in Washington, was that the amount of public data that's actually available, just because doing public records requests, Washington State is known as a sunshine state. So we can basically get records for almost anything. It's very rare to be able to find anything that is considered public record that you can't actually get access to. And there are a lot of security concerns that facilities have about, you know, all of their address information being available, but also the transport manifest information. So as it was at least previously for that, they were able to get access to transport manifests from one facility to the other. So knowing when a driver was going to be delivering product to that, making them a potential easy target for criminals. I know that later on, essentially to help curb that a little bit, even though they could not make it to where that information wasn't available, they were able to add elongated delays to those public records requests so that that particular information was a lot less useful because it was essentially at least 30 days old.
Yeah, well, you mentioned at the beginning of our talk that there was basically two types of traceability. You had the in-house traceability, and then you had the governmental traceability. Do you think as legalization opens up more and we get more and more states with legalization, decriminalization, do you think the governmental traceability will sort of fall away as it becomes less and less necessary to track this everywhere because it's becoming more widespread? I mean, cannabis is already widespread in our society, but it's half of it is underground, according to Washington statistics. So do you just think as legalization goes forward, will some of this governmental tracking go away?
I think that it's definitely going to change in the way that it's going in there. I think that there's definitely going to be more audit-based solutions and things that are out there. But I don't think it's going to go away. And the real answer for that isn't so much the diversion that it was originally put in there. It's the tax revenue. And with the states at the levels that they're actually taxing all of the cannabis products, it not being able to account for, you know, what might seem like small amounts here and there aggregates to potentially millions and hundreds of millions of dollars in tax revenue on a on an annual basis that someone may be skirting out selling at different amounts, or they may be just selling it to the correct person, but they may be reporting the wrong amounts through the system itself. So having an ability to verify that information one way or the other, it's definitely going to stay in play in some way, shape, or form. Even as, you know, recently as Oklahoma's Wild Wild West medical system that had come in there, where they've already put out an RFP for new states. And most of the cannabis regulators across the country have actually just started a consortium to where they're actually going to get together, and they have a private group where they're actually going to discuss a number of different things, laws, and try to create a greater sense of standardization across not just the industry as a whole, but also with their tracking systems.
The Brotherhood of Doom.
Yep. Is that the Cannabis Regulation Association?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah, we'll report on that. It's actually vice-chaired by the director of the WSLCB here in Washington, Rick Garza. So, it is kind of interesting to see somebody from Washington moving up on that high level, sort of on a nationwide cannabis basis. And yeah, I do kind of agree with Diggs' sentiment there. It is kind of, to me, in the spirit of the American Legislative Exchange Council. Not to get sidetracked on this, but sometimes these big groups, although they might be helpful in some ways, if they start putting out bad policies like no home grows, they start doing things like, well, here in Washington, they're taxing medical cannabis. We don't want that going nationwide. So, you know, those groups are great. We'll have to see what happens with those guys. You are doing something on your own out there on the cannabis industry having to do with traceability and data, and it's called BudWiz, and it's a competitor with some other websites out there that might be well known that I won't mention, but kind of tell us a little bit about that, and what do you think what you're doing, how that will help traceability?
Sure. So as far as traceability, I mean, it does interact with the traceability itself, but the primary concept on it is actually almost the reverse in the sense of the market itself. So when looking at a number of the other listing types of sites that are out there, if you look at, and I'll mention, you know, go ahead, Weed Maps, Leafly, things like that, they're fantastic for what they did. There's a reason they've gotten as big as they have. And I feel like the big difference between what essentially my platform does versus what a lot of theirs does is that it is from the bottom up as opposed to the top down. If you look at most listing sites and what's trending as far as purchases, stores, what the consumer market is looking for, you're looking at data based on what the stores and what the brands are putting in there so that they can mark what they're selling. But what they're selling isn't necessarily what people are buying or wanting to buy. So what I've actually done is I've created a social platform where you've got your feed, your wall, and everything. You can add your friends within the industry. And I have actually localized everything to your specific kind of a micro economy, if you will, to where you can actually view just the stores in your particular area, just products in your particular area, as well as the stores. And you can actually rate and review them on a qualitative basis. And what's interesting also about the way that BudWiz operates is that, as opposed to the way that some of the other big players are, it's not catering to the commodity market as much as it is the product market. So what I mean by that is you still have a major focus on strains. You had brought up before When you would go into the dispensary for that, you'd ask for a specific strain and they would get that for you. But they didn't generally have brand names or anything that you're going to be seeing when going into a storefront nowadays. And so the focus on the actual brand in correlation with the strain to actually marry a product and a level of consistency is definitely there, because you can say, I want Blue Dream, but one, it may be different from one time to the next, one grower to the next. And you honestly don't actually know for sure if what you're getting is Blue Dream because of the lack of standardization on those particular types of records, whereas the state actually hasn't taken a super heavy hand as far as saying which cultivars you actually have to use, or and people will make up fake names all the time. So the only way to get true consistency is by pairing it with the growers who actually did it, so that you can, you know, marry quality in that particular way.
You mean you don't want to smoke just random North American indica?
You know, I'm a little bit particular, honestly, when it comes to mine. And I'll be honest, you know, I've grown my own for so many years. I did vote no on 502, which was ironic because I was the initial project manager for traceability for the government side in Washington State. So it was a very, you know, I was very, very heavily against it. And then I got put into an interesting position to head that up in the first place. But no, I'm very particular about what types of things that I get, which again, for Budwiz, which is nice because not only can I rate and review specific products, I can follow brands that I know I like. And then when they come out with new things, I can actually see what's going on. I can look at much more intricate details about the product than you're going to have on the labels. And that's kind of another big problem, is that you're not seeing, you know, an appropriate amount of terpene profiles or, you know, other information other than what the bare minimum legal requirements are for these labels, because it's label real estate and these packagers don't want to have gigantic, you know, paper printer size, you know, packages for a gram to, you know, an eighth for that. Right. When you can have something much smaller, but you can't actually print so small that nobody can read anything. So they're very selective on what they actually put on the packages, which is unfortunately also a disservice to a lot of the consumers, because they don't actually get to see as much information about that. And it, you know, coming directly from the source, their most trusted source for finding out about that product is always going to be the person who grow it or who grew it. The other thing, as far as the rating and reviewing, is that the more products you actually rate and review, the system's algorithm will actually make recommendations based on other people that have similar likes as you do. And that's in terms of taste, as well as, you know, aroma, and not just focusing on the potency and THC, which a lot of people unfortunately still do, because that's all they really know.
So, will your algorithm radicalize me like YouTube's algorithm? Like, will I just be all about Sour D and nothing else if your algorithm gets a hold of me?
No. So the cool thing I'd like about mine is that it goes off of not just you, but it finds other people who have similar tastes on that and actually uses the information from the things that they actually like there.
So, oh, that's interesting. So yeah. It's kind of a pro version of what I've tried to do on some other sites. Like, I'll find a prolific reviewer who kind of agrees with me on certain strains, and then I'll look for other reviews by that same reviewer and be like, this guy's got kind of a similar head to me. I'm going to buy what he buys. But yeah, You've kind of taken that and made it data-driven and qualitative, which is nice.
Yes, yeah. And so your friends, other people in the local cannabis community draws from a lot of that information, being able to pull in. But if you have someone that you want to actually follow, if you have someone who's your friend on the application, on the social platform aspect of it, you can see their ratings and reviews that they put on specific products as well. You can choose to follow products. And the more you actually get involved and in the application, it's actually gamified. So you actually gain points. You can actually unlock trophies in there that are tied to specific types of events as you're actually going in there. So you can actually gain status, if you will, to try to kind of Fitbit style to compete against your friends, if you will, to see who actually does more and learns more in the cannabis community, instead of just where some of the other applications out there are a weed finder, where I just want to know what store I need to go to. And yes, the app has that, you know, to where you can see what local stores are there and what it has in the products. But I didn't make that the end all be all of the application. I made those kind of gimmies that, you know, everyone expects that at this point. So,
right. And honestly, you can shout, where's the nearest dispensary at your phone, and Google will tell you that.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, that website sounds real great. And the gamified part sounds really awesome, Dan. So we have to get out of here real quick. So tell us one more time your website and if you have anything on Twitter or Facebook or social media where people can follow you.
Yeah, absolutely. So for the website itself, it's budwiz.com. That's BUDWIZ.com. You can download the app on the Google Play Store or the App Store for your iPhones as well. It's also completely free, which is something a lot of people don't necessarily grasp right away. But if you're a producer, processor for that, and you have your brand out there and you have your legal license, or if you're a retailer, you can actually have your own storefront presence and upload all of your correct information absolutely free on the platform. And it's obviously free to consumers as well. But you can also, you can download those straight from the App Store or the Google Play Store. And definitely check it out. There's more people adding all the time. I'm up to a little over 4,000 local consumers using the app. So I'm pretty psyched about that, considering I haven't done a single advertisement really.
All right. So I want to thank Dan for that great interview and some really great insights on traceability and some things about how cannabis moves around and how governments are keeping track of it. But it looks like taxes are going to be the big thing in traceability going in the future. So that's going to move us right on to our final segment, which is our It's a Bus segment. And here we talk about the drug war, people getting arrested for cannabis, all that type of thing. This week we're going international over to the UK, and there is definitely a war on cannabis in the UK. I have friends over there that are in sort of in the cannabis space, and it is definitely highly illegal. And this time we go to a town called Crooksmoor, which, just a pro tip here, if you're going to be doing big cannabis grows, don't do them in a town called Crooksmoor. Makes you look suspicious. Just saying. So these guys were growing in this house. They had a whole bunch of rooms. Was it 200 cannabis plants they found, over 4 feet tall?
Yeah, more than half of them. It sounded like they had a couple veg rooms and a few flower rooms, and the ones that were over 4 feet tall were the flowering cannabis plants, and about half of them were flowering, and about half of them were in veg, like you would do in an operation like that.
Yeah, and they were alerted by the public, so it was probably the smell, and they said they were acting suspiciously, so there's no telling what they were doing. But
it sounds like they had, like, really conspicuous lookouts.
Yeah, but one of the concerns that I saw in the article is they were talking about how they had it all rewired, and this is actually a big issue. It can be an issue in the underground cannabis market, which is you have to have a large amount of electricity, and so some people decide that they're going to be homegrown electricians, and then a lot of times that can lead to fires. But another big thing as far as energy consumption in the underground market is people will use diesel generators. So they'll go out to like the forest and have something out there and run big diesel generators. So that adds even to a bigger, larger carbon footprint, and not safe as well.
Yeah. And even if you're growing indoor in a legal market, that was one of my concerns when I was first setting up lights. Until I learned like what the base load is and stuff, you got to be careful plugging in lights, especially some of these lights that generate a lot of heat or that pull a lot of wattage. If you plug too many lights into one breaker, you can have a real problem. And if your breaker's not working properly, or if you've got, you know, stuff daisy chained, stuff can go wrong real quickly. So when you're growing indoors, my advice would be, and that's what I'm doing, is to start small and work your way up and learn as you go, because the equipment to grow indoors, like I've been growing outdoors for almost 5 years. Growing indoors is a lot more, I don't want to say labor intensive, but knowledge intensive. You really got to kind of,
it's more detailed,
learn about light spectrums and all kinds of stuff that you didn't really have to know outside.
Yeah. And that's one of the great things John Kingsbury always he's been a guest on our show, but he always points out that's actually one of the great things about growing cannabis is you get to learn all that stuff. But yeah, I totally agree. If you are growing indoors and you are using a 200, 300, 400, 600, 1,000 watt lights, you definitely probably want to consult an electrician before you wire all that up. So be really careful out there. And there's some really great advice from Dig there. So thank you so much for being with us today, Dig.
Oh yeah, I had a good time.
Well, we're going to get out of here, but I want to remind everybody about our interaction with the audience. Send in your first time getting high stories to Dig. And what is your contact information, Dig?
You can send me an email at uncledig4@gmail.com. That's UNCLEDIG4@gmail.com. And you can hit me up on Instagram at uncledig. I love hearing from you.
This is Cannabis Corner, hosted by Lucas Barfield. If you would like to get in contact with your host, he is on Twitter at MJIsMedicine. Your musical selection is The Happy Monster by Chubby Jackson and his orchestra, recorded on 78 in 1947. You can find this music and much more at The Great 78 Project, an archive of historical music recordings at great78.archive.org. You are listening to 101.9 KTAH Radio Tacoma.